Welcome to The Political Scene. I'm Tyler Foggett, a senior editor at The New Yorker. For months, Republican Governor Greg Abbott has been busing migrants from Texas to D.C. and New York, arguing that liberal cities should bear the burden of the Biden administration's border policy. Last week, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis escalated this act of political theater by flying 50 migrants from San Antonio to Martha's Vineyard. Some of these migrants said that they were actively misled about where they were being sent and what would await them when they arrived. They have since filed a lawsuit accusing DeSantis and other state officials of executing what they call a premeditated, fraudulent, and illegal scheme in which vulnerable people were used as political props. My colleague Jonathan Blitzer, who writes about immigration policy for The New Yorker, joins me today to discuss what's happening at the border and how conservatives are exploiting it in the lead-up to the midterms. Hi, John. Nice to see you.
Likewise, Tyler.
So 50 migrants arrived in Martha's Vineyard in the middle of the night. I have so many questions about this, but the first one is, how did this even happen, like logistically?
I mean, it's a good question, and I'm not sure myself, and I'm not sure people fully understand how this operation exactly played out. The strangeness of it is that these migrants were intercepted in San Antonio, which is to say, not in Florida. So the first obvious question is, what is DeSantis doing picking off migrants to send them north from a state that isn't his?
Yeah.
And his answer on that has been strange, and it hasn't really cleared up any of the operational questions.
What has he said about it?
What he said is that he's essentially having to proactively seek out people who might otherwise end up in Florida and reroute them, essentially. And it's funny because when he's been pressed on it, people have said, oh, so like loads of asylum seekers and migrants are arriving in Florida, right? And he's even conceded the point that no, actually, there haven't been sort of huge droves of people arriving. Rather, they come, I forgot the exact phrase he used. He said something like, they're coming in like onesies and twosies. So that was the first sort of strange part of the operation. The other strange part of it is the actual mechanics of how 50 people were lured onto a plane. I mean, they were very obviously misled. They were told that there were jobs waiting for them, that there were social services that were on the way. As soon as they arrived north, they were told specifically, I think, that they were going to Boston, not to Martha's Vineyard. There seems to have been a person who sought out the migrants at and around a shelter in San Antonio. The person has been described by the migrants themselves as a woman who identified herself as Perla, but that's all that is known about her. As far as I know, people have not gotten to the bottom of who Perla was or what her specific coordination was with the governor's office in Florida, although the governor has obviously claimed credit for having been involved. So it's not like he denies being involved in the kind of nitty-gritty of this operation.
So what happened when these migrants arrived in Martha's Vineyard? I mean, no one knew they were coming, so no one was waiting, right?
That's right. I mean, I wasn't on the ground when it happened, but DeSantis did not forewarn anyone in Martha's Vineyard, or for that matter, forewarn anyone in the federal government that this was going on. So I think it's very fair and straightforward to say that the intention was to dump 50 people in a community that wasn't going to be easily prepared to handle them. And of course, like if you do that without sharing any of the logistics or giving any kind of indication that it's happening, it makes it that much harder for people to respond. I will say I have noticed that the governor's statements on Martha's Vineyard predate this summer. You know, one thing that I've seen
really?
A lot online is people say, oh, like Tucker Carlson mentioned Martha's Vineyard in July on his program and that clearly DeSantis was watching that. I think that's probably true, too. But one of the striking things is you start to see DeSantis make reference to Martha's Vineyard when he complains about immigration to Florida, in my accounting, really as early as the end of 2021. And it continues, in fact, into the early part of 2022 because there was a budget measure where essentially the Florida legislature created a $12 million fund for the state to transport migrants out of Florida and send them elsewhere. And in the language of that budget proposal and in the governor's office's touting of that budget proposal, there are also references to Martha's Vineyard. And the only explanation I can get, and I've spoken to some Florida Republicans on this and
Obama?
Some political operatives. Yeah. I mean, honestly, it's that. It's
yeah.
The idea of like, oh, this is like an elite liberal enclave. We'll sort of stick it to them. We'll show them. It's cynical and it's disgusting. And I think, and I, you know, I hate to admit it, but it's clearly, as a trolling maneuver, it's clearly been successful. It's sort of rattled liberals, as it should.
In New York, we have a right to shelter. So when migrants arrive here, the city has to give them a bed. I feel like the right to shelter is pretty unique to New York City. And so what happens to migrants when they show up, you know, in other blue cities on buses sent by Republican governors?
Yeah. I mean, really, the burden falls on the shoulders of civil society organizations and advocates who kind of mobilize to come up with essentially ad hoc solutions to get housing for people, to get kind of immediate relief to people. You know, I think some of these cities are not accustomed to coordinating on this scale with advocates. And so I think it's pushing, particularly, for example, Washington, D.C., into uncomfortable and relatively uncharted territory. The mayor of Washington, D.C. has only recently created a kind of new office to deal with this acute problem. But I think for the most part, it requires, I mean, the solution would require a combination of kind of city planning and organization, presumably federal support, but then also a lot of logistical aid and attention from advocates.
So what ended up happening in Martha's Vineyard, which is obviously a place where you would assume that there would just be fewer advocates given the size of the place and kind of how remote it is?
The response, I thought, was quite moving and quite efficient. And everyone spoke very forthrightly about their determination to help these people, to act fast, to do what is in their best interest. I think if the political calculation had been to reveal liberal hypocrisy mm-hmm. by dumping 50 people in a place that didn't want them, I do think the local response plainly disproved that premise. There was a lot of really positive local response, people turning out, people expressing their support. It actually kind of seemed like a case of a liberal community rising to the occasion.
So how was it a successful troll if the liberals on Martha's Vineyard, you know, rose to the occasion and seemed less rattled than they, you know, would have been necessarily?
You know, I felt like DeSantis overplayed his hand because, you know, the Biden administration hasn't really had a good response to some of these truly confounding questions of immigration policy at the border, and that now this gambit was so over the top that, you know, it makes it easier for members of the administration, for Democrats in general, to sort of take a stand against obvious inhumanity and cynicism. That said, I spoke the other day to a Republican operative in Florida who's deeply involved in the Latino community, who actually very plainly touted the success of this maneuver and basically sang DeSantis' praises, and not in a way that was meant to kind of be styled as a talking point, but rather to say, look, what Governor DeSantis was trying to do was he was trying to force a conversation. He was trying to make liberals deal with the fact that there is an immigration crisis, that there are acute needs at the border. The Biden administration hasn't really addressed this directly. And Governor DeSantis has managed, by sending 50 people on a plane to Martha's Vineyard, right into the heart of kind of the liberal establishment, to generate a major response. And look, the fact that we're talking about it is proof of the success of his gambit. And I have to say, what struck me about that explanation, and maybe like any good troll, it's like the liberals come away feeling certain convictions about their version of events. And in this case, the conservatives have their version of events. And it's kind of amazing how the two sides do not touch at all. There's really no overlap in the narrative or understanding of what's happened. On the conservative side, it was, you know, this was a successful effort to really force the conversation and to knock the national political conversation off of the narrative that was dominating before: Republican overreach on abortion, the success of Democrats in the Senate, Biden's increasing approval ratings, and so on. And now we're back to talking about a thing, immigration, that makes the president sweat.
So the human consequences of this are obvious and terrible, but are there potential legal consequences?
Yeah, we're going to have to see. The sheriff of Bexar County, where this happened in Texas, has announced that he will be launching a criminal investigation. So there's that pending. And in the meantime, lawyers representing the 50 asylum seekers who were sent to Martha's Vineyard have filed a civil rights complaint that will start to play out. So we'll have to kind of monitor both situations.
So if these migrants are being embraced in Martha's Vineyard and in these other liberal cities that they're being bused to, I mean, is this inherently cruel? Is this a terrible policy idea? I mean, the idea of taking people from a state like Texas where it doesn't seem like they are being embraced and putting them in a blue city where it probably is easier to get a work permit and you're not, you know, constantly worrying about being deported. I mean, I guess, is there a way in which some of these migrants could be spread around the country in a way that is actually sort of functional and doesn't involve deceiving them?
I mean, I think you're putting your finger on the central irony of the situation, which is the particular thing that DeSantis did was hugely problematic. But the actual mechanism of you know, relieving pressure at the border and transporting asylum seekers to different cities that can help give them essential services while they're waiting for, you know, developments in their court cases is not an outlandish thought. And in fact, is, I think, probably under other circumstances, what you might hear immigration advocates suggesting. The numbers that are that of people that are arriving at the border are really high. And those communities on their own, you know, in places like El Paso and places like South Texas, however well-intentioned some of their advocates and local officials may be, cannot handle this many people at this consistent of a clip. And so, yeah, there's going to be some version of needing to spread the resources around and move people who've recently arrived into the country. The problem is politically, it makes the Democrats very, very nervous because it takes a story that feels like it's just at the border and that for the most part is, I think, mostly symbolic to people, and it makes it real. But I think it's a little bit of a mirage. The Democrat fear of this issue, of the potency of this issue in that sense is a bit of a mirage. I mean, I think if the White House were much more forthright and outspoken about what it's doing, why it's doing this, kind of touting the benefits of collaboration with like-minded states, I do think the messaging battle could be won in a key way. But that's not a risk I think this particular White House wants to take, particularly before the midterms.
How much mobility is already happening with migrants? Like, you have millions of people coming. They can't all just be arriving in the Southwest and then staying there, right?
It's a complicated, you know, the numbers that we get from the government about the particular bureaucratic term that's used are border encounters.
Yeah.
And the reason that word is used is because it combines the people who are arrested at the border, who have crossed the border, and then once they're arrested, defensively claim asylum and start their legal process, and people who arrive at ports of entry asking for access into the country and protection. One of the things that complicates the numbers additionally is the existence of a policy called Title 42, which is a holdover from the Trump administration. It was brought into existence almost immediately after the pandemic started in March of 2020. And the idea was that because of the pandemic, no asylum seekers could be admitted into the country. Everyone would be summarily expelled. I think the Biden administration has sort of been caught in a very difficult position because they've been reluctant to relinquish what could potentially be a useful tool to them in terms of just expelling large numbers of people at the border because of all the political pressures associated with it, while at the same time they're obviously uncomfortable with what that means, simply suspending asylum for huge numbers of people. But the way it affects the numbers of people at the border is a lot of people have tried to cross multiple times.
Yeah.
For example, in August alone, a quarter of the people who were apprehended by Border Patrol had already been arrested and expelled and were trying again. That is an artifact of Title 42. And it's one reason why the numbers look so high, in addition to the fact that there is a lot of movement in the hemisphere. I would say the biggest story right now to people following immigration closely is the composition of who's arriving is starting to shift. So typically, over the last several years, the preponderant number of people arriving at the southern border seeking asylum have been from the northern triangle of Central America, El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala. Those numbers continue to be very large, but what we've started to see in the last year and a half are major increases in Venezuelans, Nicaraguans, and Cubans. Venezuelans alone, for instance, in 2022 made up 25% of border encounters, and that's compared to 3% in 2020. And there's obviously a humanitarian catastrophe in Venezuela. You know, 7 million people have fled the country as its economy has collapsed and as political repression has gotten worse. The situation in places like Nicaragua and Cuba are similarly grim. These people are fleeing for their lives. And, you know, there is a major Republican contradiction in particularly in Florida, how the government talks about Venezuela, Cuba, Nicaragua as these failed communist experiments that the U.S. has to be tougher on, that Trump was so tough on them. Biden is not as tough. You know, the Republican Party really sells itself as the antidote to these kinds of communist excesses in these three countries. But of course, when people fleeing those countries arrive in a state like Florida, you see what Governor DeSantis does. The Democrats have been slow and very reluctant to press on that hypocrisy because the immigration issue poses all sorts of problems for them and for their caucus.
So what's the reason for this current surge? Because I feel like Venezuela has been in crisis for years, and yet the, you know, numbers of migrants coming, it seems to be higher than ever. And is this because, you know, people weren't really coming to the U.S. during the pandemic? I mean, one thing I was wondering about is whether, you know, fewer people attempted to cross the border during the Trump administration just because of, you know, all the bravado and, you know, whether rhetoric alone was enough to sort of deter immigrants.
I mean, I really think it's all of the above. I think the fact of what's happened in Venezuela and the worsening situation there is the main driver. I think people are really being forced in huge numbers to leave. That's just an objective fact. Layered on top of that is the fact that the U.S. can't easily expel or deport people from Venezuela right now because the governments of these three countries do not accept deportation flights. Smugglers and smuggling networks are telling people now is the time. So that's also fueling a sense of opportunism at this particular moment. There's also the pandemic and the kind of just continued battering of economies all across the region. And so a lot of people also fled. And we actually saw this. It's interesting that you and I are talking now. A year ago, what we would have been talking about were the 12,000 Haitians in Del Rio who were quite brutally, we would all agree, deported back to Haiti. And part of what happened with that Haitian population, which I think also holds true here, is that that Haitian population that arrived at the border in, you know, last September, they started in other countries. You know, they fled Haiti and wound up in places like Brazil and Chile. And as the situation in those countries got worse, as the economy got worse, as a result of the pandemic and other things, global inflation, and as the politics in those countries adjusted to the presence of large numbers of immigrants, and as there started to be more hostility in the political discourse as a result of that immigration issue, they started to leave. And that's when we started to see more of them at the U.S. southern border. So there's that dynamic, too, that people have, you know, Venezuelans, a huge number of Venezuelans are in Colombia. They've been in other countries throughout the region. So there's, you know, there are a lot of these factors going on at once. I do think that it wasn't just Trump's rhetoric. I mean, Trump's policies were absolutely draconian. And I do think as a result, some of the numbers dropped. I think it was inevitable that the numbers came back at greater proportions than before. Even during the Trump administration, just to give you a sense of how this stuff always kind of boomerangs back and forth, even after the family separation crisis in 2018, the worst year for the Trump administration in terms of numbers of people seeking asylum at the border was the year after the family separation crisis in 2019, which is just to say that there are so many complex factors that are driving people to leave that certainly deterrence at the U.S. border is not enough.
Yeah.
And it does not impact people's decision making. Enforcement policies may affect someone's specific tactics for when and how they try to enter the U.S., but I don't think that, by and large, it's changing people's decision to leave and to head north.
We'll have more with Jonathan Blitzer in just a moment.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
What is the broader policy significance of what the Republican governors are doing right now?
You know, these Republican governors are really, in a key sense, kind of calling the shots on federal immigration policy. The Biden administration has tried to do a number of key things at the border. Key operational things, things that involve the U.S.'s relationship with Mexico and other countries in the region. And every time they've tried to do any number of policies that all of us, I think, would say objectively make sense and are kind of rigorous and thoughtful and reasonable, the Republican attorneys general in these states have sued and they've had favorable results in federal courts where federal judges have essentially allowed these Republican attorneys general to block Biden administration key policies for, in some cases, more than a year. And so these guys are really throwing their weight around. These governors are really throwing their weight around, and you're seeing how emboldened they are by that.
I mean, what is the role of the federal government in all of this? It's not like Abbott and DeSantis are like just acting unilaterally, right? Like they need some form of help from Border Patrol or ICE, I would assume. And do you know who the other players are here?
Yeah, I mean, the federal government is involved most definitely in handling issues of transport and things like that. In these cases, the governors have taken on the expense in some cases themselves. But the federal agents involved, for the most part, are Border Patrol agents or agents with Customs and Border Protection. And so, for example, when we're reading about asylum seekers who arrive in faraway cities, whether it's Martha's Vineyard or New York City or Chicago or Washington, D.C., who have on their court documents addresses that are listed that don't correspond to where they are. So, you know, people are flown to Martha's Vineyard and on their court documents for where they have to appear in court in order to stave off deportation lists an address on the West Coast. The agents filling out those forms are federal agents with Border Patrol.
I mean, why are they listing false addresses? I mean, I was reading sort of different explanations for it online. Like, it seems like in some cases, this is happening because these migrants don't have a place of residence to declare. And so they just like sort of, you know, the agent just picks a homeless shelter. But it doesn't always seem like it's so straightforward.
Yeah. You know, this is like one of those things that it's sort of very wonky to talk about because we're talking about forms and we're talking about addresses. And but it's a very real thing. And this has actually been a kind of simmering fight inside DHS for several months now, where there has been concern. Actually, ICE in particular has been frustrated with how Border Patrol agents are filling out these forms because they're saying, look, you're making our job more difficult. I think what we're seeing in effect is a combination of shoddiness, sloppiness at the border, clearly some malefactors who are kind of like acting rogue. And I think one of the preconceptions that explains how there can be this sloppiness or manipulation, depending on which example you cite, is, I think, the pretty universal conviction at a place like Customs and Border Protection that most of the people arriving don't have legitimate asylum claims and will lose in immigration court. And so to their minds, most of what's happening once asylum seekers are admitted into the country and then wait for a protracted period before they have their first court date is a charade. This is in the view of Customs and Border Protection agents, typically. And so when they fill out a form that basically has as someone's address a location that's far away from the court where they're supposed to appear for their first immigration hearing, that immediately triggers their deportation. And I think to the minds of some of these agents, well, fine. We're just speeding up an inevitability here.
So is there an ICE or a Border Patrol deep state? Like, I feel like, you know, Biden can sort of you know, announce whatever policies he wants. But at the end of the day, it's going to be the agents who have to enforce these things. And is what we're seeing just sort of like a holdover from Trump era ICE?
I'm really glad you put it that way. This is a Border Patrol problem. I mean, you can list problems at ICE and other federal agencies, too. But it's funny because like ICE always in the public imagination is where the action is.
Yeah.
But I actually think key elements of Border Patrol have been rogue for years. I mean, at least since the Obama years, if not before that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been a real problem for a number of administrations. And specifically, even within DHS, there is, I think, a kind of active resistance to the Secretary of DHS among certain sectors of the Border Patrol, which is quite an astonishing thing. And I think what's typically happened is DHS secretaries have tried to kind of split the difference and appeal to kind of middle-of-the-road Border Patrol agents, and they've kind of bent over backwards. Like the current secretary, Alejandro Mayorkas, I think is known for being like sort of particularly moderate in how he addresses certain staff members of his department, you know, on the assumption that there's a way to appeal to people's reason. I don't think that exists in certain corners of the Border Patrol, and I think that they do a lot to gum up the agenda both of the department and of the presidential administration.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like it goes even deeper than like the situation with like police in America.
I mean, you know, what's similar about it is how certainly during the Trump era, I mean, the problem like policing in America clearly predates the Trump era.
Yeah.
But one of the things that happened with Border Patrol during the Trump era was agents felt particularly emboldened because the president appealed to them directly. And one of the bases of his support politically inside a place like the Department of Homeland Security came from the Border Patrol Union, which is I would say, far to the right, even of what the mainstream sensibility is within the Border Patrol. You have the effect of a bunch of extreme political actors within the Border Patrol, many of whom actually, as representatives of the union, aren't involved in that much day-to-day operations, but influence kind of rank-and-file members of the agency.
What do you make of the argument coming out of Texas and from, you know, Governor Abbott that southern states, more than anyone else, have to, you know, accommodate the burden of immigration? I feel like liberals might be hesitant to talk about this large wave of migration like as a burden, because casting a whole population of people as a burden isn't necessarily the kindest thing to do. But it does kind of seem like a burden. I mean, it's a ton of people. And you said earlier that it seems like states like Texas and Arizona are really struggling to deal with these sort of huge waves that are coming from Venezuela and need to be in the shelter system and, you know, make these demands of social services. I mean, yeah, do you think that it's a burden? And do you think that Abbott is, I guess, right to make the point that it seems like Texas and other border states are sort of asked to bear the brunt of it? Or do you think that that's an overstatement?
No, it's honestly a very good question. I think they're capitalizing on something that's real, which is that, yeah, there are large numbers of people arriving that pose immediate logistical challenges to border states, and that is a unique burden and challenge for border states to handle. I do think what gives up the game a little is when you see, you know, if there are legitimate concerns about limited state resources, then you look at a policy like Operation Lone Star, which Greg Abbott, I think unleashed would probably be the right word to use for this particular policy in March of 2021, that, you know, sent something like 10,000 National Guardsmen to the border that resulted in 150,000 arrests, many of them on very dubious grounds. A huge amount of money was consumed by this. You look at a state like Florida, the $12 million budgetary measure that allows the governor to intervene, to literally go out to other states to pick off immigrants and send them north for a political stunt. I mean, no one's complaining about the resources there.
So is that the intended use of that $12 million, or is it supposed to be $12 million for the transport of migrants, you know, from Florida to other places, and DeSantis is just sort of taking it and using it in ways that no one expected or desired?
I mean, I think that I actually think of all of the concrete ways in which DeSantis has really strayed from the legal script, to kind of use almost an odd euphemism for it. It's that, you know, that budgetary measure was explicit about the fact that this involved moving people from Florida. I spoke to a Democratic state representative who made the point that, you know, maybe, and this shows you how confused everyone is about the actual, like, logistics of that operation still. She said to me, you know, maybe, you know, that those flights to Martha's Vineyard stopped twice, once in Florida and once in North Carolina. And she was speculating that maybe, you know, the fact that the planes touched down first in Florida was like a little bit of a kind of a legal rationalization. But no, I don't think that that budgetary measure allowed the governor to do what he's just done. And again, like, you know, to ask this question about resources, you know, these flights alone, I mean, these flights are upwards of $600,000-$800,000. You know, these are flights with 50 people on them. So I do think the pressures of large numbers of asylum seekers and the pressures that imposes on local communities that's a real thing. I think there are ways of dealing with it. And I think by and large, like, given the enormous wealth of the United States and the resources that do exist here, I think that there is a way of handling it all equitably. But I do think liberals often ignore, at their own political peril, like, what some of the kind of, like, intuitively uncomfortable facts of large numbers of people arriving are, and why people might smart from that.
Why is the Biden administration so cagey about? Because you would think that coming from Trump, who, you know, obviously there was the kids in cages stuff. I mean, you would think that, like, anything would be, you know, an improvement from that.
I think, I mean, this is a really interesting question. Part of me is optimistic that DeSantis overplaying his hand with this particular stunt kind of, like, newly energizes the White House, which,
yeah,
is already kind of coming off of a fresh set of victories in the Senate and so on. It's a kind of a fascinating case study in an administration that comes into office very keyed into what it knows a major policy problem is going to be, which is the situation with asylum seekers at the border. And I actually think during the transition, there were officials in the Biden camp who are as smart as they come on these issues and who made very concrete plans and set very sort of specific benchmarks for how to ramp up a system that the Trump administration had deliberately subverted, how to do that with political pressure bearing down on them, kind of setting goals that were achievable, that would kind of piss off both sides equally but allow them to chart a course. And I think what happened was they got spooked. They got into office. There was some staff turnover. So the transition gave way to the actual administration. But I think the real inflection point for the Biden administration was March of 2021, when there was a major increase in the number of unaccompanied children who showed up at the border. That, to anyone who was following this as a policy matter, was to be expected. The fact that it was happening was actually the result of all kinds of factors, but the Biden administration was actually handling it relatively well. But they got spooked because the political coverage was terrible. And actually, Biden's first press conference as president was on immigration, where he was having to answer all of these really hostile questions about how can you let this be happening at the border? What are you doing? Is this because you were too permissive on the campaign trail? Did you promise too much? Are people coming because they think you're going to be soft? It goes to the need for Democrats to speak up, to forthrightly articulate what their values are and why we would be helping people. But in the absence of that, I really do think the Republican narrative has a pretty substantial intuitive appeal. And it's not just enough to point out the contradictions, as I am, to say, oh, well, look, if you care so much, why are you spending, you know, $12 million getting people out of your state? You could use that money to help them.
Thanks for coming on, John.
Thanks so much for having me.
Jonathan Blitzer is a staff writer at The New Yorker. He is at work on a book about the history of the United States, Central America, and immigration from the 1980s to the present. This has been The Political Scene. I'm Tyler Foggett. The show is produced by Michelle Moses, with support from Sydney Cobb. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. Thanks so much for listening.